is Professor Anthony Arrett. Dr. Arrett was born and educated in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where he attended and later taught at the Carnegie Institute of Technology, noted not only for its engineering and science, but also for its College of Fine Arts. From 1956 to 1968, Dr. Arrett carried out experiments in magnetism and the physics of metals at the scientific laboratory of the Ford Motor Company. During this time, he used the neutron facilities of the National Laboratories at Oak Ridge, Brookhaven, to find the patterns formed by atomic magnetism. In 1964, he was awarded a John Simon Guggenheim Fellowship to study magnetization waves at the Atomic Research Establishment at Harwell, England. Since 1968, Dr. Arrett has taught physics at Simon Fraser, is now head of that department. And in addition to that, he has done work in magnetism. He investigates the order that occurs in certain organic liquids with long molecules called liquid crystals. He's the author of over 100 scientific papers, and he's presently on the Physics Grant Selection Committee of the National Science and Engineering Research Council of Canada. I noticed that Dr. Arrett's title was The Pattern and Rhythm in Physics, Biology, Mathematics, and Art, which I think is an indication of his wide reach and the breadth of his interest. But time limitations has dictated a shortening to Pattern and Rhythm in Physics and Art, and I give you Dr. Arrett.
This is a Jackson Pollock. These are also Pollocks. The period is 1947 to 1951. New York had become the center of the world of painting. It was the time of the triumph of abstract expressionism. Room-sized canvases were stretched out on the floor, and Pollock stepped into the painting to use the reach of his arms and the swing of the enamel paint can to produce swift, flowing, continuous lines, some quick and thin, some slow and flooding. Hear what Pollock said at the time about his own work. "When I am in my painting, I'm not aware of what I'm doing. It's only after a sort of get acquainted period that I see what I've been about. I have no fears about making changes, destroying the image, and so forth, because the painting has a life of its own. I try to let it come through. It is only when I lose contact with the painting that the result is a mess. Otherwise, there's pure harmony, an easy give and take, and the painting comes out well." Critics of the time called him Jack the Dripper and deplored what they called chaos. But there is order in Pollock's paintings. He has controlled the overall texture. It is even and balanced. The elements of shape and color leave each other freedom. The eye and the brain interpret these as patterns which could extend beyond the canvas with ceaseless movement and limitless depth. This is a periodic space-filling pattern by the Dutch graphic master M.C. Escher. Escher used space-filling patterns as elements in his graphic solutions of mathematically posed questions. From 1937 to 1945, he developed these patterns into representations of metamorphosis, as in this 1938 etching night and day. Woodcut, sorry. Didn't come up. Thank you. The last work of this period was his Magic Mirror, in which you see the winged dog slowly emerge from the mirror, part from his image, form a procession of interleaved objects and images which merge into the tile tabletop. From 1946 to 1956, Escher tackled problems of perspective with an imaginative yet analytic approach that made the concepts of above and below, right and left, near and far, appear no more than relative and interchangeable at will. This cubic space-filling pattern was a study for his 1951 mind-twisting lithograph, House of Stairs. From 1956 to his death in 1970, Escher produced two-dimensional realizations of mathematical concepts. Perhaps none quite so intriguing as that of infinity. To quote Escher about his prints, "The ideas that are basic to them often bear witness to my amazement and wonder at the laws of nature which operate in the world around us. He who wonders discovers that this is in itself a wonder. By keenly confronting the enigmas that surround us, and by considering and analyzing the observations that I had made, I ended up in the domain of mathematics. Although I am absolutely without training or knowledge in the exact sciences, I often seem to have more in common with mathematicians than with my fellow artists." But then perhaps he has made contact to a time when art and mathematics were closer. His work was inspired by his studies of Islamic patterns at the Alhambra in Spain. The powerful appeal of pattern can be traced back to this ceiling of an 18th dynasty Egyptian tomb over 3,000 years ago, or still further back to the invention of the cylindrical print wheel in Sumeria some 5,000 years ago. This is a photograph taken recently in the picture gallery that is the New York outlet for the work of the French painter and theoretician Victor Vassarelli. Vassarelli uses science to produce art. Painters have long been fooling the eye and the brain by the use of color and perspective into finding three-dimensional space on a two-dimensional surface. I quote, "In optical art, however, perspective is reduced to the state of utter ambiguity. Color is divorced from its customary associations, and the artist leaves the eye to dance according to its own inner light, or to turn away if it must." I'm quoting from an anonymous writer in Horizon describing the school of optical art in 1965. Continuing, "Precisely delineated images on flat surfaces trick the eye with an impression of perceptual change and motion. Ovals and circles seem to spin. Rectangles of color alternately advance and recede in unstable relationships. Straight or sinuous lines ripple, fuse, separate into constantly shimmering patterns. Images of one color are succeeded by after images of another, alternating in giddy pulsations. The disturbed eye is led a wanton chase, even to the point of inducing vertigo. In contrast to all logic and precedent, this so-called optical or retinal art is deliberately made to be hard to look at. Well, it's even hard to look at when I make a mistake on the slide. Well,
recovery.
Into this darkened room intrudes an aesthetic that derives from the commonplace. This is pop art, as practiced by Roy Lichtenstein in 1961, and it serves as a bridge to the liquid crystal patterns photographed by either Dr. M.J. Press or myself between 1971 and 1975. These are taken using a 35 millimeter camera and a polarizing light microscope. With these pictures, one enters into a world that is primitive, remote, and lacking in symbol, illusion, allusion, or delusion. Like all other images shown tonight, they are just light from a slide projector, which stimulates the retina, the optical neurons, and enters the brain. If there is meaning in this, where else could it reside but in the mind's eye of the beholder? The title of tonight's talk is Pattern and Rhythm in Physics and Art. The subject is much less sweeping. The physics is restricted to liquid crystals, and the art to paintings, mostly 1948 to 1968. You may want to know what is a liquid crystal. If so, it is hoped that you will soon find out. You may also want to know what is art. On this, so many volumes have been written over the ages that it's easy to conclude that the answer is so complex that if it were to be answered tonight, we might agree with Pogo that the answer has spoilt the question. Without answering the question, I would pose a framework for its discussion, constructed on the concepts of pattern and rhythm, the perception of the mind's eye, and the role of the brain as a value-driven decision system. Within this context, it may be possible to know something about why we like certain pictures. Water is a liquid. Diamond is a crystal. Here is a picture by Chardin. That soap bubble is one form of a liquid crystal. In this familiar liquid crystal, long molecules are neatly stacked in layers with their axes parallel to one another. But within each layer, the molecules move about like people wandering in a crowd. The liquid crystals seen earlier are not quite like that. This sketch by Escher shows a crystal lattice. This is a solid. To make a liquid, it's necessary to replace each cube and its outreaching arms by a molecule of more freedom. Something like the fish in Escher's wood engraving called Depth. Let all the fish swarm in more or less the same direction, keeping their distance from one another, but not rigidly as in a lattice. This is a model of a liquid crystal. The fish are long molecules, which have chemical names as difficult as the biological names of fish. If you think of the fish, it is as good a picture as any for the molecules. The liquid crystal is a liquid. It can be poured. In any drop, there are trillions of little fish. Even in the thin soap bubble, which 100 or so layers of fish are stacked parallel to one another. The fish are not really parallel to each other any more than the minnows in a school swimming together through the water. It is just that if you look at a great many of them, you see a more or less common direction. That direction we call the director field. It can change from place to place, like the brush strokes in Van Gogh's Starry Night. Let the brush strokes represent the direction along which the millions of fish are more or less aligned at each point. The change of direction is like the bending of a piece of plastic. It's not hard to do, but if left to itself, it would straighten out. But this is not always possible. The stars are painted with brush strokes that circle about the centers. Far from the center, there's little bend from stroke to stroke. But the same pattern continued to the center creates a lot of bend. If the molecules in a liquid crystal were to follow a circular pattern like this, there would be a lot of stored bend energy in the center. Van Gogh could have maintained circular symmetry by using brush strokes coming out radially from the center of symmetry, as in these two patterns. In the language of liquid crystal elasticity theory, Van Gogh has used a bend or curl pattern, while these two are divergent or splay patterns. The strains in liquid crystals are curls and divergences. The curls are of two types. One is bend, the other is twist. The divergence or splay is like the radial pattern. The liquid crystal would prefer to have the direction change as little as possible. While these slides are here, notice something that has nothing to do with liquid crystals, except for the fact that liquid crystals have something to do with the brain. These patterns are taken from the well-known book, Eye and Brain. The right side, or visual side, of your brain sees a white ring in one figure and a black ring in the other. But the left side, or verbal side, of your brain says this is an illusion, for logically, if the white ring appears white, it must be whiter than the white background. And for the black ring to appear, it must be blacker than the black background. Yet we know that this can't be true. While I'm digressing, let me show you this picture of Van Gogh's stars being born. This is taken from Carl Sagan's book Cosmos, based on his television series. Let me take you back 3,000 years to this Egyptian tomb. The physics question, which formed part of Dr. Press's thesis, is what is the pattern found in a drop of liquid crystal? Does it bend, as in Van Gogh's stars, or splay, as in the psychology pictures, or does it spiral, as in the Egyptian tomb picture? To answer these questions, we use theory and observation. The theory gives quite simple laws to minimize the strain, but the results of those laws can be quite complicated and require modern computers for their solution. And then only if you make an initial good guess of the solution. Our observations were made on droplets of liquid crystals floating on water. These little droplets are like fat globules floating on the surface of soup. The size is such that it is 1/8 of an inch across the picture frame. Light passes through the water and through the thin droplets. They are shaped like thin lenses of the double convex type. Here we have placed a piece of Polaroid in the path of the light. The light is polarized parallel to the bottom edge of the slide before it passes through the water and the thin droplets of the liquid crystal fluid. This polarizer has little obvious effect until we take another polarizer in the path of the light, leaving the droplets and going into the eye or the camera. If that second polarizer is turned through 90 degrees, the background goes black, but not the droplets. One notices two effects. There are colored rings and black brushes. If the direction of the molecules lies parallel to the axis of the polarizer, in this case parallel to the bottom of the slide, then the light does not change the direction of its polarization. It remains the wrong way to go through the second polarizer. The result is blackness in the vertical direction. If the axis of the molecular alignment is parallel to the side of the slide, again the light does not change the direction of polarization, and this accounts for the horizontal darkness. But if the molecules lie at any other angle, say at 45 degrees, the polarization of the light is rotated on passing through in such a way that some light now gets through the second polarizer, which we call the analyzer. The extent to which this happens depends on the thickness of the liquid crystal, on the extent to which the molecules lie in the plane of the surface, how well the molecules are aligned to one another, and the nature of the molecules themselves. It also depends on the color of the light. And this is the effect that you see. If you rotate the drops by turning the water upon which they float, the patterns do not change because each drop has circular symmetry. By looking at the black brushes, one can tell roughly the pattern taken by the molecules. This is but a two-dimensional picture of a three-dimensional problem. Note that the brushes do not all do the same thing. If you hadn't noticed this, you will appreciate that it took us 3 months. To notice it in the days before we started taking pictures and were only relying on looking through the microscope. There are three drops of the same size with three quite different patterns. If you look at this drop right up here, and the one above it and the one just above it, those three drops all have just about the same size. But in one of them, the cross turns counterclockwise, and the next one up, it goes straight through. Sorry. And the top one turns clockwise. We have three drops, the same size, three different patterns. Part of Dr. Press's thesis was to explain how one problem can have three answers. It is because the laws are simple that we can have multiple possibilities. In this next picture, taken just after the first one, they are out of order, I guess. In this picture was the first one, and right after that picture came this picture in which you can see that some of the drops have disappeared from this side over to that side. And the big drop in the center is the one that has the guilty look. From which he recovers after a bit of digestion. When we try to explain these things to physicists, we are not so imaginative as Escher, So instead of using fish, we use beer cans. This is a model of the center of the drop. The labeled cans are the ones which are aligned so as to appear black between crossed polarizers. There is also a trick which we can use to show the direction of alignment visually. Instead of water, we use antifreeze upon which to float the drops. Then, for some mysterious reason, small bubbles of some liquid appear inside the liquid crystal, and they line up as strings of beads along the direction of the molecules. Where the strings are vertical or horizontal, one finds the dark brushes. The pattern is one of gentle spirals. The color is like a rainbow, but it is more like the after image of the usual spectral display. As one comes in from the edge of the large drop, the thickness increases and the color develops from gray towards a yellow. The violet component of the light is rotated the most and the red component the least on passing through the liquid crystal. The violet is the first component to rotate beyond where it can pass easily through the analyzer. If you stare at a violet light and then look at a white wall, you will see yellow. The absence of violet from the spectrum creates a similar yellow. Where the liquid crystal is a bit thicker, the blue disappears, giving an orange. And still thicker, the green is no longer passed, but the blue and violet return, and a reddish color dominates. When the red goes, green dominates. One can reverse the color change sequence by making the molecules all turn into the direction of light, which would be out of the board. Here, this is done with one drop in a multiple exposure using a magnetic field to align the molecules. They are more aligned at the top. One can change the color also by heating. For then the alignment of the molecules is less the higher the temperature, until at a sudden temperature, the liquid crystal is said to melt. The optics of liquid crystal lenses produce a sense of an unfamiliar world. Night and day in this world of worlds is produced with polarizers and a quartz wedge. But the drops themselves in direct light have their own mysterious shades of darkness. In addition to splaying and bending, the director field can twist. Take a solid surface and lightly plow it like a field by rubbing the surface in one direction. The liquid crystal's long molecules will follow the furrows when in contact with such a surface. If I take two plates properly furrowed and confine a liquid crystal between them, I can turn the top plate, keeping it parallel to the bottom plate, until, say, the furrows are at right angles. The director field will then twist from the top surface to the bottom surface. Such a pattern is used in the optical displays for calculators and for watches. Some liquid crystals like to twist. If the two furrowed plates were free to rotate, the liquid crystal would turn them to create a twist pattern. The further the plates were apart, the further they would twist. It would take a little bit of work to straighten them back out. Instead of plowing our plates, Dr. Press and I coat them with a chemical that makes the molecules stick up from the surface like a prairie wheat field. The liquid crystal director field would like to twist, but first it must bend away from the vertical to obtain a component in the plane. The greater that component, the more effective the twist. The bend stores elastic energy. If the plates are far enough apart, that energy can be drawn from the energy released by freely twisting in the mid-region. To see what happens, we take two chemically treated plates and form a gentle wedge filled with liquid crystal. At one end, there's so little space that one gets only blackness. At the other end of the wedge, there's so much room that many things happen at once. In these patterns, there is a certain amount of repetition with wave-like spatial periodicities. The contrasting blue and green on the right show that there are two distinct regions. One preserves the sense of up from the bottom plate to the top plate. As the director bends over, twists, and comes back up again. In the other region, requires the bend to turn over, twist, and then come back up the opposite direction. And you reverse the sense of up and down. One case like this, the other case like this. These patterns pay homage to Pollock. To understand the wave-like periodicities, we want to look at the region where the spacing between the plates of the wedge is just enough to let the liquid crystal start to bend over and begin to twist. As we scan in from the thicker end of the wedge, we find more regions of well-developed periodicity. At the critical spacing, we reach what we call the seashore. We see a black region at the bottom, which is towards the thin edge of the wedge. We see the dots, which are probably small regions where the director field turns over from the top to the bottom. I'm going like this. This stores elastic strain energy, which cannot be released because it's like a knot on a string whose ends are not free. The periodic pattern at the top is unexpected and easy to misinterpret. By using monochromatic yellow light on black and white film, we can see more clearly the nature of the finger pattern. The black at the bottom is the region where the director field goes straight from one surface to the other. The spacing of the fingers is about 3 times the distance between the plates. It looks as if the black region extends in between the fingers, but this is not quite the case. Actually, it is not as black between the fingers. It just looks blacker because of the nearby white. There is a continual variation in the degree by which the yellow light is rotated. Every other fringe corresponds to one full rotation of the plane of polarization of the light. This is not because of a variation of thickness. This is uniformly thick. The liquid crystal is uniformly thick between the two glass plates, except for the slight taper. Everywhere you look, including the black, the thickness is about the same. What changes are the angles made by the molecules with respect to the direction of the light, which is out of the screen. The pattern is described as follows. At each point, the director field bends over, starting from the bottom surface, then twists and bends up again at the top surface. But the degree by which this happens varies continuously and repetitiously as we go from finger to finger to finger. In the center of this finger, it bends down far before it comes up. Between the fingers, it bends a little bit before it comes up. If we think about the mid-plane between these two plates of glass and look at what the direction is doing in that mid-plane, we find it's rotating about a cone. as we go in one direction. The director field is up like this, and then it rotates and comes around like this and back up and around like this, and it does it like this periodically. There are many variations on this pattern. Instead of parallel patterns, we can get circular ones. Here is the circle in the yellow monochromatic light shown at the bottom. Some of my favorite patterns are variations on dots when they stretch out into lines. Here I'm getting representational. The dots and the lines present a palette from which to produce abstract expressionist images in the style of the 1950 master William de Kooning. Here is our homage to abstract expressionism. The next two pictures are more in the spirit of colored field abstractions. Color field abstraction led rather directly to optical art, of which Bridget Riley's 1965 painting is an example. The lines are not always so neat. This picture was taken at the point of time of the Watergate hearings in Washington. The power of the visual system to organize is never so evident as when there is a face to be seen. On heating towards the melting point, one develops a certain expression which is difficult to classify. I can't decide whether I like them or not. We might consider this one as our contribution to op art, except that the double exposure has the accidental quality of gesture painting rather than the control of a Vasarely. The liquid crystal that likes to twist looks a little different from the first liquid crystal we looked at when they form drops. There is some similarity here to the Egyptian tomb ceiling pattern. It is also possible to form colored donuts. Somewhere midway between Escher and abstract expressionism are these two-dimensional space-filling patterns formed by a liquid crystal at the thicker end of the wedge of the treated glass plates. These pictures of liquid crystals, to me at least, produce a response not unlike that of watching a sunset, but perhaps more like viewing a picture of a sunset. Much of what I see in the microscope is changing with time and on a scale well suited to human amusement. Not so fast that we cannot contemplate the view, and not so slow as to be boring. Time-lapse photography of a flower blooming when shown as a movie is exciting to watch. This is so because the time scale is chosen to be just right. In much of the work that Dr. Press and I have done, we use a television camera connected to the microscope with the images appearing in color on the picture tube. In this way, we can view the same changing scene together in working out the theory of how the patterns form. We recorded and played back these pictures using videotape. A moving picture can superimpose its rhythm on that of the eye. Perhaps the best movies are those where the rhythm is in harmony with the natural response time of the mind's eye. This natural response time also comes into viewing still pictures. The eye moves over the picture plane in a series of fixations. Between fixations, the eye, I am told, doesn't see. The greatest detail of the visual field comes from the small region near the center of the eye called the fovea. If you are sitting in the middle of this auditorium, say 45 feet from the screen, the fovea maps out an area about 1 foot in diameter. To fully take in a picture of this size would require about 100 fixations, each of which lasts about a third of a second. What the eyes are seeing sharply at any one time is only a small part of the total sharp pattern that is being put together in the mind's eye. When looking at the live image of a TV screen, I translate the specimen with respect to the light path in order to see what patterns appear at different places. Often this requires that I change the focus to keep the pattern sharp. On playback of the videotape, I am always a bit annoyed at how long it had previously taken me to realize that the new scene was out of focus. I have ample time to remark out loud about the slowness of my previous response before the focus takes place. The video recorder also has a voice track, which I use to deliver a commentary as the experiment proceeds. On seeing a new phenomena, there is a long delay between its appearance on the screen and the time I might say, "Look at that." For a while, I thought that there was some delay in the soundtrack. I couldn't believe how slow I was to vocalize the first time what was so obvious to me so quickly the second time viewing it. This effect is still there when I look at the tapes years later. Through these videotapes, I have produced a record of my responses to a completely new visual experience. The eye sees only what is in the mind's eye. The picture is built up sequentially in a way determined by what task the brain seems most suitable to the occasion. But once a pattern is in memory, it can be recalled very quickly, sharply, and as a whole. The time delay on focusing is less than on commentating on the appearance of a new phenomena. The signal from the visual response of the right side of my brain to an out-of-focus picture is sent directly to my hand on the focus knob without verbal interference. This response is like driving a car or the quick movement of an athlete to a changing visual pattern. These are done using only a few visual clues, probably faster from the peripheral vision than from the central fovea. Focusing demands input from the fovea. The sudden appearance of a large dark object in the peripheral vision evokes a very fast response. To a fish, it means he's about to be eaten. The verbal response to a visual stimulus requires communication from the visual right side of the brain to the verbal left side, and it is my experience that this is very slow. I have been told that it is faster in women than in men, for they seem to have more connection between the two halves of their brains. As the eye scans a picture in a series of fixations, there must be something that determines the paths traced. By what criteria does the brain command the eye? Perhaps the greatest amount of research on this question has been done by artists over the ages. Though they lacked the modern scientific apparatus that can record what the eye is doing, they have clearly thought about it and experimented on themselves and the viewers of their work. Of all the objects that attract the eye, perhaps the most attractive is another eye. It is one question to ask how the eye and brain look at pictures, and another to seek the reason why they function in the way that they do. If we were to contend that the primary function of the eye is to recognize pattern, then there would still be the question of the purpose of pattern recognition. Perhaps these are not separate questions, for if we knew the purpose of pattern recognition, we might better be able to define by what we mean by pattern. Patterns should include time sequences, as well as spatial variations, and audio and other senses, such as smell and touch and balance, as well as the visual. But the spatial pattern is subject enough for the moment. Solomon Guggenheim is remembered for his museum. He was one of seven sons of the silver baron Meyer Guggenheim. He and his brothers turned a fortune into a super fortune in the 1920s and thereafter contributed to science, the arts, and technology. The recent space pictures from Saturn owe much to Daniel Guggenheim, for he started Goddard's rocket work and started the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in both Princeton and at Caltech. Solomon was a practical man who also collected art. He particularly liked Kandinsky. Kandinsky is credited with the beginning of abstract art. Solomon Guggenheim is reported to have said, "All day long, I add up columns of figures and make everything balance. I come home, I sit down, I look at a Kandinsky, and it's wonderful. It doesn't mean a thing, and there's nothing to understand." Perhaps that is what it's all about. The eye is there to help the brain to understand, and the eye and the brain get some momentary pleasure out of understanding. What is easier to understand than that there is nothing to understand at the moment? No immediate threats and no puzzlements. The simpler the pattern, the easier it is to understand. The computer understands only one-dimensional time sequences. The eye and the brain understand two-dimensional arrays and by visual clues construct three-dimensional images, generally sacrificing accuracy and detail for rapid understanding. Abstract art presents patterns for themselves and not as symbols or images to recall what is stored in the brain as familiar objects or subjects. The aim of abstract expressionism was more than that. The artists were searching within themselves for the essence of themselves, and they felt they needed to be free from the constraints of representing the observable. They didn't deny nature in their abstractions. Hans Hofmann, who was a teacher of great influence on a generation of American abstract artists, always painted from nature. Pollock's wife, Lee Krasner, recalled Hofmann's meeting with Pollock. She states, "I brought Hofmann up to meet Pollock for the first time, and Hofmann said, after looking at his work, 'You do not work from nature.' Pollock's answer was, 'I am nature.' Pollock used his nature to produce pattern. This pattern is not quite the same thing as a pattern produced on the ceiling of an Egyptian tomb. But it has in common with it that it seems as if it could go beyond the visible boundary. If so, there must be some rule by which it could be continued." Pollock captured the imagination of the United States when Life magazine in 1950 photographed him in the process of painting what are now considered his masterpieces. 20 years later, Pollock's painting, Blue Poles, which you see here in several pieces, commanded the highest price ever paid for 20th century art. Part of my personal interest in Jackson Pollock is the result of spending 3 days putting together a 2,000-piece puzzle of this picture. How is it that even though the eye can discriminate each region of the painting, and one piece of a puzzle from the next, there is still an overall uniformity to this work. What is the pattern and what is the rule? There is no change in the pattern when a circle is rotated by any degree about an axis through its center. The canvas itself has fourfold symmetry about that axis. Every turn of 90 degrees brings the picture back to where it was. This figure has mirror symmetry. If you turn it upside down, it looks different. But if you look at it in a mirror, it looks the same. Mirror symmetry is always a little puzzling. Why is it when you look in the mirror, your right hand and your left hand are interchanged, and your head and your feet are not? This Escher has a twofold symmetry if you also interchange the red and the gray when you turn it around. The rules for mapping the upper part of this Vasarely into the lower half are more complex than you might guess at first glance. This Escher has a lattice. It also has two horses, which are identical except one faces left and the other right, and one is white and the other is not. Here is another lattice, but it fools you at first, for the lattice is much larger than the nearby birds, and every bird appears facing both left and right. If you're looking for the lattice, it's from the look from the bird just up from the corner, the first full bird, and there he appears at the top as a full bird, and he appears just off the screen, just leaving the screen on the far right. This Vasarely does not have exact symmetry of any kind, but the mind perceives it as having pattern, and indeed a fourfold pattern with mirror planes that do not exist. Here the symmetry is only an approximation, but that is good enough for the mind's eye. Magritte fools the eye with his painting called Euclidean Walks. The initial symmetry is an illusion that slowly dissolves as the eye struggles to separate the painting in the painting, and the scene being painted. This Franz Klein is a figure eight, or at least an abstract expression of a figure eight. The rule doesn't have to be as simple as a symmetry rule. The rule for balance is quite different. It depends only on the sum of its parts. This picture of a Calder mobile has balance. Jasper John's Flags has a pattern of scaling. Each of the three canvases stacked on top of one another repeats the pattern on a larger scale. There has been some considerable scaling in the value of this, from its original sale price of $900 in 1956 to its recent purchase by the Whitney for an even $1 million. None of the above rules applies to Pollock's paintings. To extend this painting onto the gallery wall, we can return to the language that physicists use to describe liquids and glasses. It is also used to describe the disordering of magnets and liquid crystals. No two regions are ever the same, but there are similarities from place to place which are described in terms of probabilities. In this 1972 painting by Larry Poons, one sees more disorder than there really is. Every dot is placed with respect to a grid, and these three dots and those three dots up there, just above that, are in exact relationship to one another. The disorder dominates over the order in the mind's eye. In this larger work by Poons, the order dominates over the disorder. In this liquid crystal picture, we can see order and disorder. The dots are quite similar. They tend to form local arrays, but not any overall order. A dot is much more likely to be surrounded by six dots than by seven, and more likely by five than by four. One could analyze Pollock's paintings in terms of probability, but it would miss the point of the painting as much as it would be to analyze a computer by looking at all the little elements and measuring all the voltage signals. That would be like analyzing man by poking at his neurons and recording his brain waves. We know a lot about how the eye and brain respond to patterns. From optical art, we see how the visual right side of the brain responds to conflict in the interpretation of pattern. In case you have forgot, here is another Bridget Riley. From Escher's work, based on this Penrose triangle, we see how the verbal left side of the brain reacts to illogical patterns transmitted from the visual side. But this does not answer the larger question, why? For this, I recommend two books. In his 1954 to 1974 work, Art and Visual Perception, A Psychology of the Creative Eye, Rudolf Arnheim discusses balance, shape, and form, what children see, space, light, and color, movements, and dynamics. He covers the spectrum of visual experience and summarizes it with the statement that the human mind receives, shapes, and interprets its image of the outer world with all its conscious and unconscious powers. In this, the eye is dominant, but it is not allowed to reign unchecked. If what the eye reports is in conflict with what the other senses or past experience perceives, there is serious trouble. This is likely to cause one to become sick, as in seasickness or car sickness, or in the more recently discovered space sickness. Interpretation of the outer world is necessary for survival. But one could hardly interpret every input by asking how it affects survival. George Pugh has described man as a value-driven decision-making system in his book, The Biological Origins of Human Values. Pugh points out that one cannot play chess by asking whether each move will win or lose the game. The answer to that question usually is, who knows? One needs more specific secondary values in order to make decisions. These are supplied by genetics and by inheriting an environment with which and in which the individual can develop. A baby brought up by a wolf can never achieve the performance that we would call human, let alone to found Rome. But a baby does not need to be taught to see. A blind man that gains sight at an advanced age never learns to use his eyes fully as part of his process of interpreting the outside world. The primary thing that a living creature does is to interpret his surroundings. An interpretation requires criteria for decision. The mind is a decision-making organism. It is programmed with a need to decide. Decisions are value judgments. What are the values and how do they arise? Much as I would like to give Pugh's arguments and discuss how they fit into the importance of pattern and rhythm in nature and art, I will leave it as a thought. Let me return to Solomon Guggenheim in closing by noting that peace of mind is when the perception doesn't mean a thing and there's nothing to understand. But that is only the resting state of the mind. Its main function is to search for understanding. To quote Camus, "I am convinced that man's life is a long journey to find the two or three images that first found access to his heart." One final word. I could not have done this without my colleague, MJ Press, and I've saved Murray's favorite slide for last. When you are looking at the liquid crystals, the liquid crystals are looking at you. And if I can get Murray to stand up and take a bow. Murray, stand up and take a bow.
You've got time for some questions. Please speak clearly and keep them short. Yes.
Well, you know that the difference between a liquid and a vapor is only evident if you have them in coexistence across an interface, because you can always, by pressure and temperature, take a liquid continuously from the liquid to the vapor. And so, in principle, the vapor can be taken around to the liquid by going above a triple point and coming in. But for the liquid crystal, because it's a first-order phase change, I don't think there's any such path from the vapor. That's a technical answer, but I think it was what was meant.
Yeah. Yes.
Tony, can you give us an indication of the range of behavior of liquid crystals? Do you use only one kind of liquid crystal, and what other things do you do?
There are two types of liquid crystals in here. One we call pneumatic, which is one where the molecules all like to be parallel to another, and the other, which is called a cholesteric. And the cholesteric is the one that gave those periodic patterns, because this is one that actually likes to twist as you go through the liquid crystal. It likes to twist. That's the cholesteric. Now, there are symmetric liquid crystals of all kinds. To some extent, your brain is a liquid crystal, and there are these. Any long molecule will generally form some sort of ordered state, which is still not a rigid lattice like a solid. And these are varieties of liquid crystals. Probably one quarter of all organic liquids are liquid crystals. And the whole body functions on liquid crystal membranes. Most membranes that go on cell walls are like the soap film, again, something of a liquid crystal made out of material close to lecithin. And that has all the proteins and all the important things. So liquid crystals are important to you.
Yes.
Can you repeat that?
Yeah. The question is, how much do the works of Escher influence the interpretation of results? Well, the answer is that Escher's brother was a crystallographer. and as such, Escher was greatly influenced by these sort of things. But that's really not where he got interested first in the periodic patterns. It was from his second visit to Spain that he, at the Alhambra, that he really got interested in it. He worked for many years just doing his woodcuts before he came into this. And it wasn't until much later that he got the idea that the space-filling pattern was sufficient unto itself. If you notice, the 1938 Night and Day was done with the space-filling pattern only worked into the woodcut, not as the woodcut itself. Whereas there's a whole book on crystallography, which Carolyn McGillivary edited, which is full of Escher's demonstration of all the two-dimensional space patterns with all their color variations. And that's one which physicists and mathematicians always like. Turns out that Escher is much more popular among the scientists than he is among the artists.
I'd like to ask, is there a question there?
Generally, there's a place where it goes through what we call the first order phase change. That's a technical word. What it means is ice melts. Or that the ice and water coexist together in glass. They're both at the same temperature. One's solid and one's liquid. There's no question about what, which is which. For a liquid and a gas, it's quite different. For a liquid and gas, it's continual between the liquid and the gas. It's only when you have them coexisting with a pure phase that you can tell the difference. Liquid crystal, though, because of the long molecules, undergoes a certain type of alignment that makes the molecules all parallel, and that gives them optical properties that one generally associates only with certain solids. But one could think of putting long molecules in a lattice, like a solid, and then you have two things that happen. The long molecules in this order respect each other stay on their lattice sites, and that would no longer be resistant. The optical effects, and then the thing can melt when they left their sites. The other thing that happens is they can lose their sites and still be parallel to one another, and that's what the liquid crystal is.
Yes.
Very able to put your product puzzle together?
Yes. I spent my boyhood, Suso, doing crossword or doing jigsaw puzzles. 3 days, but I was also teaching and doing some research.
I'd like to ask Dr. Eric Boat, acting president and vice president of UBC and professor of physics, to thank our speaker for a truly eye-opening lecture.
Ladies and gentlemen, again, we have an Institute night in which we have a great deal to be thankful for. Those of us who've known Tony for a long time have admired his restless energy and the quick intelligence with which he is constantly interpreting his world and his environment, as we've seen today. We're grateful that 12 years ago he was brought to Vancouver and to Simon Fraser University. And you know, he wasn't even brought by Gordon Shrum. he was brought to Simon Fraser University, and you may wonder why it's taken us so long to get him to the Institute, but we're very grateful that he's here tonight. We're also grateful he was channeled at one point in his career, channeled throughout his career, by his wife Pat, who's with us here tonight, to think more about art. His wife Pat is a very talented artist, and I'm sure has contributed a great deal, Tony, to your long-term interest in the subject. We learned a great deal from Tony tonight, not only about art and physics. I, for instance, learned why 3 months ago when we went on an airplane trip, Tony on the 747 was walking down the aisle like this. He reacts in a very lively way to the world, and I think all of us have again perceived that tonight. We've had a very interesting evening, and on behalf of the entire audience, I want to thank Tony Arad for his lecture tonight.